All right, ladies and gentlemen, please come on in and get your seats. I'm going to introduce our member of the Gold Circle, who is our member of our Board of Governors, who is going to introduce our next speaker. Marjorie Dannenfelser is one of our conservative leaders in the pro-life movement. She is the president of Susan B. Anthony's List. She is published in the Weekly Standard, the Washington Times, and other national papers, and a regular contributor to Fox News, to CNN, CBN, and others. No doubt have seen the work of Susan B. Anthony's List and their work in electing pro-life leaders, but also in advancing pro-life legislation in Congress. She has been a key part of advancing the 20-week pain bill with the 5-month ban on abortions after 5 months. So please help me welcome a member of the Council for National Policy to introduce our next guest, Marjorie Dannenfelser.
I have the great pleasure of introducing truly one of my favorite people. And I think when you hear from him, if you haven't before, you're going to agree with me. And I want to tell you why he's that person to me. He is a great human being. And in Washington, D.C., you can say a lot of things, and you can give a great bio of a lot of people, but there are very few people that you can say, this man is a really, or this woman is a really great human being, and it's just true. I don't know if you know this, but I'll tell you, when Lindsay was a kid, or not a kid, he was going to college, his mom and dad died. Within about a year span, and his sister was 13 years old at the time and left an orphan. He was over 18, so he wasn't legally an orphan, and he adopted his little sister and changed his plans and raised her. Most people don't know that, but it's the kind of person that Lindsay is. He is a cheerful warrior in the face of obstacles continually. After 2012, that miserable election, the abortion issue was pretty, on the life side, was in jeopardy of being buried permanently by the Republican Party, by operatives, by all the smart folk who said, this issue is radioactive, stay away from it. We were on 100% defense. If there's anything that Lindsey Graham is, he is a man who is going on offense on the things that he believes. In 2012, we decided that the pain-capable bill at least stop abortion after 20 weeks. How about if we, as a society, at least take as a nation that modest proposal of stopping abortion after 20 weeks? We shopped that idea around. Most people on Capitol Hill said, you know, that is way too ambitious, far too ambitious. Let's just do it in D.C. Let's experiment and see if maybe D.C. will... we can impose this on D.C. Well, does anybody in this room think that stopping abortion after 20 weeks is too ambitious for this country? Absolutely not. Lindsey Graham agreed. There were many senators that we went to that will remain nameless that said, you know, I don't know, what are the constitutional questions that we should be resolving? We need some consensus among senators about the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment. And so there was delay and foot dragging. When we spoke with Senator Lindsey Graham, he's like, bring it on. Let's do this. And all the senators who are dragging their heels, let them vote. If they're concerned about constitutional issues about a 20-week ban, let them vote against it. And of course, not one of those people did. Senator Graham is that person that the pro-life movement not only needed then, but we need him continually. And why is that? He is the best strategist. I've been doing this on Capitol Hill for more years than I'm going to tell you. He is the best strategist as a sitting member that I've ever come across. He doesn't just put his name on the bill from day one of the strategy on the pain-capable bill. He has looked at this as a strategic operation like a warrior would. He understands how to lobby on both sides of the aisle. He from day one was working very closely with us about how to bring in the votes that were probably outside of the realm of possibility. I just want to, those are things you may not know about him. This is something that I do, and the pro-life movement is a better movement for his warrior-like attitude and his going on offense. So I give you one of my favorite people, Senator Lindsey Graham.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm one of my favorite people, too, so Marjorie, thank you for the kind introduction. I'm from South Carolina, in case you can't tell. Anybody been there? Come back, spend money. It's been a tough 2015. All I can say is I'm ready for this year to be over. The shooting in Charleston, you remember that? It was probably a turning point in the history of South Carolina. It was an opportunity to understand what faith was all about. How could you appear in court and forgive the man who just killed your loved ones? Faith. Understanding where God fits in terms of now and hereafter. So when the victims' families appeared in court and looked the shooter in the eye and said, I pray for you, I forgive you, it changed everything about who we are in South Carolina in all the right ways. After that, it became impossible not to deal with the flag because the reverend who was killed doing the Bible study had been one of the leading voices of move it from the front of the Capitol to a museum. I've lived in South Carolina all my life. I've never been more proud of my state than I am now because we came together, black, white, rich, poor, the churches were full, and based on the leadership of the families of the victims, we came together and we're moving forward together. I would give anything if that would happen for the country as a whole, wouldn't you? So let's talk about my favorite subject, politics and me, starting with me. I was born in a small town in South Carolina called Central near Clemson University. My dad owned a liquor store, a restaurant, and a pool room. Great training to be your president. I ran the pool room as a kid. I met a lot of liars in my life. That's why I know the Iranians are a bunch of liars. The bottom line is neither one of my parents finished high school. I'm the first in my family to go to college. My dad was a World War II veteran. And it was hard work, 6 days a week. You had Sunday off. Get up early, stay late. If you own your own business, you can't get sick because if you don't get up and go to work, you don't get paid. We lived in one room in the back of the restaurant, literally one room, no shower, no bathtub. Anybody ever taken a bath in a metal wash tub? Look how well we turned out. When I was early in high school, we bought a manufactured housing, a mobile home, put it in the back of the lot. And I remember having a room for the first time. And right before I got out of high school, we bought the house next door. The only reason I tell you this is to be unconditionally loved is the greatest gift a parent can give a child. It's not the size of the house. It's not the size of the bank account. I came along late in life, so did my sister. My dad was almost 50 when I was born, in his mid-50s when my sister was born. My mom was an angel and a saint. I've never doubted one minute that my parents loved me, sometimes in spite of what I did. The bottom line is life was good until it wasn't. In 1975, the Graham family went to Disney World on a vacation. We got on a plane for the first time. We had more than a day off for the first time. And we went to Disney World, and it was like going to Mars for us. We came back, and my mom started getting sick. And by June of 76, she had passed. Probably late diagnosis of Hodgkin's disease. We were an underinsured family. and we got wiped out financially. The strain on my dad was obvious. How do we pay these bills? 15 months later, while I'm at the University of South Carolina, he passes away in his sleep with my sister, who is 13 at the time, at home with him. So when I'm 22, both parents have passed. My sister is turning 13. We move in with an aunt and uncle who made $25,000 at the most working in the textile plants. And if it weren't for family, friends, and faith, I wouldn't be standing here. If it wasn't for a Social Security survivor benefit check, we wouldn't have made it. If it wasn't for college loans, Darlene would have never gone. I don't need a lecture from a Democrat about Social Security. I don't need to be told about health care. I understand. Now I'm running for President of the United States. What a country. The bottom line is I've been in the Senate. This is the beginning of my third term. In this outside-inside contest, I understand being frustrated with anybody associated with politics. But here's what I don't understand. Why would anybody elect a commander-in-chief who doesn't know what the hell they're doing after Barack Obama? The 1% who serve this nation are depending upon you to pick a commander-in-chief worthy of their sacrifice. You, the public, get to pick their leader. Don't pick someone who doesn't have a clue about how the world works, who our friends are, and how to destroy our enemies. You've got 15 people to choose from, 3 basketball teams. If you can name them all, I'll take you to lunch. So I'm going to talk about 3 quick things and take some questions. You liked that, did you? Good. Social conservatism, fiscal conservatism, and national security are the foundations of the Ronald Reagan approach to conservatism in life. Marjorie introduced me as being the sponsor and the author of the 20-week pain-capable bill. Are you familiar with that legislation?
Yeah.
It's a pretty simple proposition. What good comes from abortion on demand when the baby's 5 months in the birthing process? Explain to me how we're a better nation. I just asked that question. I've yet to hear an answer. We have exceptions for rape and incest and the life of the mother. Very rare circumstances, but we make exceptions for those 3. And what we're trying to do is get out of a club of 7 countries. Do you realize that your nation is one of 7 nations in the entire world that allows a baby to be aborted on demand in the 5th month? How do you feel about that? You want to change it? Well, you're going to get a chance. And here's your chance. All 15 of us would sign that bill. None of them will. Is that simple enough? How can we beat them if you care about this issue is what you should be thinking about. How do you beat a Democrat? You get more votes than they do. How do you get more votes? You sell conservatism to a wider group of people. We're running against some interesting folks, aren't we? The number 2 candidate on the Democratic side went to the Soviet Union on his honeymoon. And I would argue has never come back. The leader of the pack feels like she and her husband were flat broke after 8 years in the White House. That's maybe why they took the China. How could we possibly lose to these people? But none of them would sign the bill that most Americans would love to be signed in law. Whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, at 5 months, babies actually have survived the birthing process. At 5 months, I think most Americans are with you. That's just one example of what it means to win the White House. If you want to build the Keystone Pipeline, all of us will, none of them will. If you want to defund Planned Parenthood, which you do, right? and move the money somewhere else? All of us will, and none of them will. Pick one of us that can beat one of them. Because if you lose, God help us all. Fiscal conservatism. Did you listen to the Democratic debate? Did you feel good about the direction our economy would go? Everything was about taxing the rich. Wall Street was a bigger enemy to America than ISIL. When asked about the biggest threat to the world, it was climate change. These people have lost their way. On economic policy, if you believe in lower taxes and a deregulated America and taking a risk and starting your own business, all of us on our side give you a better hope of achieving that end. And just about all of them are looking at Denmark as their guide. Now, I like Denmark, but they're not going to lead the free world. So on economic policy, it's a choice between more taxes, the entrepreneur is the enemy, more government, and less choice, and it's pretty clear. On the national security side, it's the difference between understanding the world and having your head in the sand. What's the biggest threat to America? Debt and security. I would argue the biggest threat to our way of life is radical Islam with a weapon of mass destruction. I would argue that the only reason 3 million of us died on 9/11 and not 3,000 and not 3 million was because they couldn't kill more of us. I would argue that the Democratic debate showed a level of delusional thinking. Israel wasn't mentioned one time. They were behind, leading from behind. This is the most important issue of our time, is to make sure that radical Islam is destroyed. The reason I'm running for president above all others is after 33 years in the Air Force, 35 trips to Iraq and Afghanistan, I am the best prepared to be commander-in-chief on day one, and I'm gonna find and kill all these bastards I can, and we're gonna build up others. First call I make is to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. What do you need that you don't have? We're gonna rebuild the Army. We're gonna go to 500,000, not 420,000 under these defense cuts. We're gonna have a 350-ship Navy, not 275. We're gonna have the best airplanes, not the oldest airplanes. We're gonna have a two contingency Marine Corps, and we're going on offense. Israeli mothers will sleep at night because I will have their back. We will set aside this deal with Iran, and the only reason the Ayatollah is not dancing over this deal, he just doesn't believe in dancing. Barack Obama is a completely incompetent commander-in-chief, and John Kerry is delusional as Secretary of State. And if you don't understand how important it is to rebuild our military and use it differently and smarter, then we've lost our way as a party. This flirtation with isolationism from our libertarian friends, I hope, is passed. If I'm president, the NSA program stays in place. It doesn't go away. We're going to have court interaction, but if there's a terrorist on one end of the phone, I want to know who's on the other end of the phone. We're going to send troops back to Iraq to destroy ISIL because it's in our interest to do so. We have about 3,500. We need about 10,000, according to the commanders that I rely upon. When you're running for president of the United States on the Republican side, you better have a plan different than Barack Obama to destroy ISIL. Does that make sense to you? Well, I've got one a lot different. More American ground troops. A couple of Army aviation battalions with attack helicopters flown by American pilots to Wynn and Ramadi and Mosul. Forward air controllers to make sure we drop bombs on the right people, and we actually drop them. 70% of the airplanes come back with the bombs on the racks. Special forces on the ground in Iraq, morning, noon, and night. If ISIL picks up a phone, they get in a car, they're going to get killed. We're going after their leadership. Trainers and advisors at the battalion level so the Iraqi army is less likely to cut and run. If you don't want to be aggressive when it comes to destroying ISIL, don't vote for me. If you want a plan different than Obama, vote for me. If you want something other than just talk, vote for me. Syria is hell on earth. There is nobody hardly left to train. If you don't destroy them in Syria, how do you keep them from coming back to Iraq? And if you don't destroy them in Syria, where their headquarters live, exist, how do you protect the King of Jordan and Lebanon from falling one day because of the war in Syria? How many of you want to protect the King of Jordan? How many of you are pro-Israel? Well, you better come up with a game plan to protect the King of Jordan, because he's in the crosshairs of ISIL. What would I do as President of the United States? I would take the fight to ISIL where they reside in Syria, and I would use the Arabs and Turkey as the centerpiece of that fight. Can you imagine how the guy feels who finished second to Barack Obama for the Nobel Peace Prize? He has done one good thing. He's driven the Arabs and the Jews together unlike any time in the last 2,000 years. Every Sunni Arab state, including Turkey, which is not Sunni Arab, they're Turkey, now want to destroy ISIL because they're coming after them. Every one of them wants to get rid of Assad because he's a puppet of Iran. How do you do it? You're not going to do it from there. Does that make sense to you? We're not going to win this war from there. It should make sense to you because we're not. So the ground component I would have would be Arab armies with Turkey to go in on the ground in Syria, 90% them, 10% us. We'd pull the caliphate up by the roots and we would hold it. Then I would turn to Assad and give him a choice. Stay and die or leave. I'd say to Putin, ISIL is a direct threat to our homeland. I will not stand by and watch you prop up Assad, because that means this war never ends. It means the people in Syria won't accept him and the war continues, the refugees continue to flow, and if you want to fight for him, you're welcome to do so. As to Putin in general, I would export natural gas that we own in abundance and cut his legs out from under him economically. I would rebuild NATO because it needs to be rebuilt, but I'd first rebuild our military. I would give Ukrainians the right to defend themselves by giving them weapons to fight back against Russian intrusion. I would sanction the hell out of him and his oligarch buddies. As to China, you'd have a clenched fist or an open hand. If you keep building islands over resource-rich waters owned by others, forget about trading with us as a normal nation. If you cyber attack us, steal our property, you're going to pay a price. We will suffer, but you will suffer more. You need our economy more than we need yours. If you're ready to lead from the front, pick me. If you're ready to fight the enemy over there before they come here, pick me. ISIL wants three things: purify the faith, destroy the one and only Jewish state, and kill every infidel in this room. I am not going to let them do it. I am going to declare war on radical Islam and stay with it, and as long as it takes, and whatever it takes is my policy, until we win. As to our friends in Israel, I will make sure the Iranians do not possess the ability to cause death to Israel. To the Ayatollah, if you want a nuclear power plant, you can have one, but you're not going to get an enrichment capability, and you're not going to get a dime of money or another bullet until you change your behavior. And if you try to break out, I'll stop you. If you want a war, you'll lose it. And I would ask the Congress to give me tools to create leverage. If you do business in Iran, you can't use our banks. And I'd wait till the phone rang. And I'd say, we can do better because we have to do better. I believe the Ayatollah is a religious Nazi. I believe he's compelled by his version of Islam to destroy the Jews. And I believe America and the world has made the same mistake we did with Hitler. We don't know who we're dealing with. These people are religious fanatics and they're never going to change. My goal when it comes to Iran is regime change, is to give the people inside that country a chance to live a better life. I feel really prepared to be Commander-in-Chief. I will get our country out of debt. And that means working with Democrats and Republicans across the aisle to adjust the age of retirement of Social Security and Medicare. And it means flattening out the tax code to pay down some debt. I'll talk about that in a minute with Tony. This is the best chance we've had and will have in decades to win the White House. I think I can beat her. Her definition of flat broken mine are a bit different. If you're looking for something new, it's not Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. This will be the most important decision the Republican Party makes, maybe ever. Check me out.
Thank you, Senator Graham. Thank you for spending a few minutes with us. And as you are familiar with the Council for National Policy, we're an organization that is kind of an umbrella for fiscal conservatives, social conservatives, foreign policy conservatives. So our questions will cover the conservative landscape here.
And the umbrellas are not made in China.
That's right. They're made right here in America. All right, we're going to begin first following up with just what you were talking about in terms of our military. And this question comes from Rich Bott.
Thank you, Senator Graham. I do have a question on foreign policy, national defense, so this should be right in your wheelhouse. Programmed defense cuts and plus sequestration cuts are devastating our military readiness. Furthermore, social experimentation has destroyed morale in the armed forces. However, the greatest threat to readiness is the all-out attack on religious liberty inside the military, which makes recruiting and retention of quality people impossible. What would your priority actions be regarding the restoration of military readiness? And please address the religious liberty component of this.
If you're a major in the United States Army, you have a Bible on your desk, you will never be told to take it off. If you're a chaplain in the military, you'll be allowed to practice your faith within the tenets of your faith. If you're a religious person in the military, you can express yourself. We'll talk about marriage later. The bottom line is the defense cuts fully implemented are insane. You're going to have the smallest army since 1940, 420,000 members of the army. You're going to have a 275 ship Navy, a one contingency Marine Corps, and 50% of the combat coded squadrons in the Air Force will be grounded because they can't fly and train. You'll be spending 2.3% of GDP on defense at the end of 2021, and we historically spend 5% on defense. This is nuts. I would set aside these defense cuts, but let me tell you this. Mike Mullen said the biggest threat to our nation in many ways is our debt. How many of you agree with that? Can I talk about that for a second? You cannot defend the nation when you have no money other than to pay the Medicare and Social Security bills. By 2040, Medicare, Social Security, and interest in the debt will consume the entire revenue stream that you send to Washington and Texas. Why? Because 80 million baby boomers like myself are going to retire in the next 25 years. We're going to want a Social Security check, and we're going to want the Medicare bills paid. And we're down to two workers for every retiree in the next 20 years. Unless you want to have four kids after you're 67 like Strom Thurmond, we've got a problem. What would I do to get us out of debt? I would sit down with Republicans and Democrats and do what Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan did. He adjusted the age of retirement from 65 to 67 in 1983 to buy his 40 years of solvency. It is time to do it again. Anybody here born after 1964? Good luck, because the baby boomers are depending on you. You're going to have to work a little bit longer, because we all live so much longer. I make $175,000 a year. I'm not saying I'm worth it. That's what we pay ourselves. Would I take a smaller COLA? You better believe it. Would I shave my benefits a bit if I needed to keep it for those who need it more than I do? Yeah. When I was 22, I needed every penny. I'm 60, I'm not married, I don't have any kids. I'd take less. And I'd ask everybody like me to take less to save a program that keeps 50% of today's seniors out of poverty and to keep your country from becoming Greece. You can't tax your way out of this problem. You could take the entire wealth of the 1% and their dogs, and that's $30 trillion if you took everything. You're not going to grow your way out of this mess, and you're not going to cut your way out of this mess. You could eliminate the Department of Defense, which is 20% or 1/3 of the budget. The debt is driven by the retirement of the baby boomers and promises in Medicare and Social Security we can't afford to keep. You're not worth a damn as president if you're not willing to deal with this. Obama has let this get worse. He took the Simpson-Bowles Commission and threw it in the garbage. Ronald Reagan took the Greenspan Commission and made it a reality. I work with Democrats. To some, that's a sin. To me, it's a requirement to save a country. If we don't work together on this issue, our way of life dies without a shot being fired. Yes, sir, I'll rebuild our military. You'll have a robust army at 500,000. You'll have a 350-ship Navy, 14 aircraft carriers, not 11. And when America talks, people will listen. But none of that's possible if you don't deal with your debt. And you're not going to get out of debt from an ideological point of view. You have to have an American president that can bring us together and get both parties to give.
Senator, you mentioned the issue of marriage, and our next question revolves around that. It comes from Preston Knoll.
Thank you, Senator. Since the Obergefell decision, where five lawyers imposed same-sex marriage on our nation, we have seen good Christians like Kim Davis be persecuted and jailed by our government. So I have two questions. First, do you accept this decision as settled law? And second, if you are elected, what specifically will you do from day one as president to ensure our conscience protections and our freedom of religion?
Day one, I would get with Congress, talk to Tony, talk to you, and come up with a way to make sure that the First Amendment right to practice one's religion is not affected by the 5-4 decision. I would point conservative judges that would be less likely to make it settled law. And you ask the ultimate question, what would you do on day one? Start thinking about Supreme Court picks, because time does march on, and these people are getting to be like senators. They're in their 80s and their 90s. So I would have a statutory fix, clearly defining that no person in this country or religious institution is required to marry people outside the tenet of their faith. That if you're a mosque, synagogue, or a church, this 5-4 decision will not require you to perform a marriage outside of what you believe religiously. I would put a ring of protection around the First Amendment right to express yourself and to engage in religious freedom practices. Then I would try to pick Supreme Court judges that maybe over time would not make it settled law.
Let me drill down on that for a moment, Senator, to ask you a question just to be clear on the issue of religious liberty. As we talk about religious freedom, according to the First Amendment, do you see that as revolving around an institution in your activities in a church, or does that flow with and go with
goes in the marketplace? I mean, what's good is to have a liberty if you can't exercise it, right? Sure. Yeah, absolutely. The ability of religious schools to have admit people based on religious concepts. We're not going to allow religious institutions outside the church to lose. You're talking about tax-exempt status, okay? Isn't that what we're talking about? We're talking about, will an institution lose their tax-exempt status if they don't perform a marriage in a certain fashion? Will a school not be able to admit people with student loans or lose their tax-exempt status because their religious beliefs are outside this court decision? The answer, if I'm president, is no. The First Amendment trumps, on the religious liberty side, the Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court case is limited to marriage, and it's not settled law if you could get a constitutional amendment to overturn it. It's not settled law if the Supreme Court down the road changes it. What you need to have in terms of your president is someone who will build protections around religious liberty and the free exercise thereof, and make sure that this court decision is not taken by the IRS or any other body down a very long and dark road. And the only way you can assure that is to have a president who gets it, right?
Right.
How many of you believe that Bernie Sanders will not agree with what I said? All right.
Unless there's some giveaway with it, he probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
All right, our next, speaking of giveaways, our next question is on the issue of economics in our...
I like Mike Lee's bill, by the way. Are y'all familiar with that?
First Amendment Defense Act.
Yeah, let's start with that one.
Bill Walton, Vice President of CMP, asks our next question.
Hi, Senator Grant. Thanks for joining us today. As you know, the Obama administration has pretty much destroyed the middle class. For example, average household incomes have dropped by about $5,000. And yet, during the same 6 years, 95% of all the wealth created in America has gone to the top 1%. Can you explain why this has happened? And if you were president, what would you do to reverse these trends?
I can explain it. Y'all ready to listen? Middle class people are not getting good paying jobs because Obama's economy is a nightmare for the middle class. I've got a simple theory about how to help the middle class. Create competition for their labor and their services. Hillary Clinton's got a list a mile long about helping the middle class. It has one thing in common: more government. You're not helping the middle class by having a $15 hour minimum wage that will knock people out of the workplace. You know how you help the middle class? One, what is it? The middle class is a group of people who make too much to be on government assistance and still live paycheck to paycheck. Do you know anybody like that? I grew up with people like that. The reason the middle class is not sharing in the economy is because the economy is stuck. The best thing I can do for a waitress is create an opportunity for somebody else to open up a new restaurant and hire her away. How do you open up a new restaurant? Anybody ever bought a house without borrowing money? Come to my fundraiser if you raise your hand. If you bought a car without borrowing money, seldom. If you can't borrow money, you're not going to grow the economy. Elizabeth Warren and her friends have shut down borrowing. Okay, you own a business. You own a restaurant. You got 48 employees. Would you hire three more? No. Why? Because you're covered by what?
Obamacare.
If you're a manufacturer, are you going to expand your workforce not knowing what the EPA regulation and carbon will be hold for you because of your energy cost? Everybody's afraid to hire because it costs too much under the Obama regulation, tax, and litigation model. So to the middle class, if you're looking for government to fix your lot in life, you've turned the wrong way. The only hope you have is for the economy to grow, and the only way the economy is going to grow is for people to borrow money and take a risk. When Boeing came to South Carolina to build the 787 Dreamliner, why did they choose us? No unions. Why did they choose us? We'll build it quicker than you even thought you could build it yourself. You can get a permit like that. You need a workforce? We'll train them for you. Tell us what you need. We got technical schools, and we'll make sure people show up on time. They work hard and give you value for what you pay them, and we expect you to treat them right. Volvo just came to South Carolina. You know why I like Volvo? It's easy to spell. We have BMW. We have Volvo. We have Boeing. We have a lot going on in South Carolina because we make it easy for you to come to our state and succeed. We don't beat on you. We welcome you. We make it easy for you to create a job and easier for you to make money. And I want to take the South Carolina experience to Washington and make it easy for everybody in America to do that. Because let me tell you why. When Boeing came to South Carolina, you were in a manufacturing business. If you didn't pay more, guess what? You were going to lose your employee to who? Boeing. And if you don't pay well at Boeing, you're going to lose your employee to Volvo. The only way I know to help the middle class is grow the economy, and I know how to do that.
Very good, Senator. So I know now why South Carolina passed on Volkswagen. Can we talk now about immigration?
Yeah, totally. Let's talk about it.
Right, we're going to anyway. So let's go to Tom Fenton for our next question.
I can't wait to talk about this.
Tom Fenton, Judicial Watch. First of all, we really appreciate your leadership on Benghazi, but the question is on immigration. America's foreign-born population is now estimated at 42.4 million, 13% of the population. A million more immigrants came in, I think, legally from 2013 to 2014 alone. You know, this transformative, potentially mass migration hasn't been debated or approved by Congress or the American people. You know, first on the illegal aspect of it, how exactly will you secure all the borders, land, air, sea, from illegal immigrants? And will you curtail the influx of millions of legal immigrants? And how many lawful immigrants, for instance, should be allowed to enter the U.S. annually? And how long should they be allowed to remain?
Okay, good question. We have two borders, one with Mexico and what country? I've never met an illegal Canadian. I'm looking for them in New Hampshire. Isn't it kind of odd that we're not overrun by illegal Canadians? They come to Myrtle Beach in March, they go swimming, we're glad to have them, and they leave. None of us want to swim in March. So I don't agree with you about legal immigration. Let me tell you what I would do as your president. I would fix the problem rather than yell about it. Yes, you got to secure your border, because if you don't, they'll just walk across the street and keep coming. Most of the people here are here to work. They come from economically deprived regions. They make more money in a month here than they make in a year there. But that's no reason to not have order out of chaos. So if you don't secure your border, it keeps coming. Reagan gave amnesty to 3 million. We all love Ronald Reagan, but just didn't follow up. I would double the number of Border Patrol agents from 20,000 to 40,000. That's one every 1,000 feet. Triple the number of drones to have 24/7 coverage of the border. But it's about a job, don't you think? As long as you can get a job here, they're going to keep coming. When you pay an illegal cash under the table, you're hurting every working person in the country. Any of you ever worked in a meatpacking plant? You ever been to a meatpacking plant? 99% Hispanic. You can advertise till the cows come home under our law. You can't get a foreign worker until you advertise for 90 days above minimum wage with health care benefits. Then you can get a foreign worker if one's available. We advertised at the PGA, when the PGA tournament came to Kiawah Island in South Carolina for service workers. We had 12 people after 90 days apply and 3 failed the drug test. I had to go beg for Jamaican maids. So here's my belief. There are parts of our economy we need more legal immigration. We're down to 2 workers in the next 20 years. Where do the workers come from? We're dying out. We're living longer and having fewer kids. The lifeblood of this country in the future will be immigration. And if I am president, it will be merit-based. Why just pick somebody from Mexico? What about the kid from China who's really smart, who studies in our schools, and we kick him out? Isn't that stupid? Give him a green card and let him stay here and start a company. So here's my view. Secure your border, control the visa problem. 40% overstayed their visa, and mostly they come from the Mideast and other places for visa overstays. Control who gets a job, a national e-verify system, where within minutes you can find out if I am really Lindsey Graham. What's the one document you need to get a job in America? Social Security what? Card. Anybody like Ronald Reagan? I make you Ronald Reagan by midnight. I make you Tony Perkins by midnight. Let's have a biometric document that you can't cheat Let's give employers a chance to have access to legal labor when they can't find it here, and when they hire somebody legally in the future, put them in jail and take their business away from them. Then it'll stop. And it will only stop if you secure your border control, who gets a job, and increase legal immigration. And if you don't believe we need legal immigration increases over time, you're not looking at the same world I am. And here's the good news for America. Assimilating people is so American. America is not a race, a religion, or an ethnic group. It is an idea that many of us embrace. As to the 11 million, nobody wants a felon. If you stay, you have to speak our language as a condition of stay. I don't speak it well, but look how far I've come. You have to pay a $2,500 fine to help us pay for securing the border. Get to know the IRS by paying taxes like the rest of us. And you can't apply for a green card for 10 years because you did break the law. And you have to get in the back of the line of the country where you came from. That is my solution. That will never happen unless you get bipartisan buy-in. I reject the idea that we should restrict legal immigration. It should be based on the economic needs of this country. When you project out in the next 30 to 40 years, we're going to be needing workers unless we have a baby boomer of 60 years, baby boomer of 60-year-olds. By 2050, Caucasians will be a minority in this country. Does that mean conservatism dies? There are Hispanic churches full of people just like you. How did we get to 27% from 44? You're going to have a guy coming after me says, we're going to deport them all. And the good ones are coming back through a really big door and a big wall.
Actually, huge.
Huge door. That's about as honest as if you like your doctor, you can keep it. It's about as honest if you're going to pay less for Obamacare. The truth of the matter is that's not going to happen. There are not 10 votes in this Senate or House, really, for mass deportation of 11 million people, including their legal citizen children. So I don't want to tell you something I don't believe, and it's up to you to vote for me or not. But the one thing you're not going to do is vote for me based on me trying to tell you something I don't believe. Here's what I believe, that illegal immigration is a national security problem. It's one thing to put a roof on the house, it's another thing to blow the house up. So I want to get this behind us. And this is killing us as a party. When you say most illegal immigrants are rapists or drug dealers, it doesn't go over well, because most are not. And here's the dirty little secret. A young woman with her husband came here 25 years ago. They've lived here all their married life. They had one child who was illegal, who's probably now 20 years old. They've had two kids, legal citizens, one in the Marine Corps, because the Hispanics joined the Marine Corps higher than any percentage of people in the country. The young Hispanic sergeant comes back home, wants to meet his mother. You haven't heard? She's walking back to Mexico. Truck's coming to get them all. You're just telling that young American Marine that his mother, father, and older brother are bad people. I will not do that to win an election.
Senator, one final question here for you before we go into our lightning round of questions. You are the author in the Senate of the Unborn Child Pain Capable Bill, which would prohibit abortion after the fifth month. This question revolves around the issue of life, and Troy Newman has this question.
Thank you, Senator. Troy Newman, Operation Rescue. I've spent the last 30 years saying that if you can't trust a president with the unborn baby's life, we can't trust them with battleships because there's no inherent dignity of human life. So my question is, would you as president ever approve a budget that includes federal funding for Planned Parenthood or any other abortion facility? And if the answer is no, would you ensure that our continuing resolutions, or I would prefer budgets, for funding the government were passed without also approving funding for abortion or Planned Parenthood?
If I were president, I would not sign anything into law that had one penny for Planned Parenthood. I would take the money and put it in other places. okay? I am not going to do something in 15 that I think will lead to shutting down the government and causing us a chance to win the White House in 2016. I voted to defund Planned Parenthood. Why did the framers allow the president to veto a bill and require two-thirds of both bodies to override the president? To slow things down. To make sure that very ideological driven causes can't make it through unless you get consensus. All I can say is that the public will be with us over time on Planned Parenthood, and every Republican will defund Planned Parenthood, and every Democrat will keep it in their budget. It will not be in my executive budget, not one penny, sir. But it will be in hers. It will be in Bernie's. It'd be in Chafee. It may be in metric form, but it'd be in Chafee's budget. The bottom line is, I don't want to leave an impression with you that I think we're going to defund Planned Parenthood without a pro-life president, because we're not. I don't know how to pass my 20-week partial pain-capable bill unless you get somebody in the White House who believes like us and will sign it. I think most Americans agree with us on both issues. But the president of the United States is not a ceremonial job. Do you all agree with that? The commander-in-chief, they have power of a pen. Let's win the White House. We all agree almost everything. Every one of us would sign the 20-week pain-capable bill. All of us would build the Keystone Pipeline. All of us would defund Planned Parenthood. It's just a matter of tactics. All of us would repeal and replace Obamacare. But how do you get there? And the only way I know to get there with certainty is win the White House and work with Congress to get things done. The reason I know that will work is because that's what the founders intended to happen.
All right, Senator, thank you so much. We're going to now move in to kind of a lightning round of questions that we ask all the candidates. And I'd ask you if you'd keep your answers to 30 seconds or less. We can move through these, and folks are going to want to take their photographs with you.
Absolutely.
When we wrap up here. Upon your election, if you're successful, would you rescind President Obama's executive orders? And then how would you use executive orders?
I would fire everybody he hired. I'd put somebody in charge of Department of Labor that ran a business, not a union. I'd put somebody at the EPA that produced energy, not hated it. The first executive order I'd sign was to go back to Ronald Reagan's Mexico City policy. That's pretty close. That's 28 seconds.
That's pretty good. I'm glad you can count, Senator. Name.
Not required in this job, by the way. Go ahead.
Name, you know, as we've talked about conservatives, you're known by who you hang out with. Personnel is policy. Name some conservative movements that you counsel with, speak to, have relationships with.
You know Mike Ferris? Is Mike here? He's a very smart guy and a great dancer, believe it or not. I talked with Mike about parental rights legislation to counter what the UN's doing. I'm the author of it. Marjorie, Doug, the whole pro-life crowd, they practically live in my office. Bob Heckman's been my buddy for years. Art Leffler on the economic side, Steve Moore. When it comes to foreign policy, General Boykin, General Keane. I hang out with pretty good people. You'd like them. Gary Bauer. I like short people doing well. That's why I hang out with Gary. I can say that because I'm the same size.
How does your faith impact your decision-making? And as if you were to be in the Oval Office, what role would your faith play?
I've got a long-term political goal. I'm going to heaven and working backwards. See, heaven, you don't have term limits. What good have you gained if you have the whole world and lose your soul, right? We are a diverse country where you can worship God, libertarian, vegetarians, but the President of the United States has to be true to who they are. I want you to know who you're getting in me. I will work the other side when it matters for the country, because we can't get there just looking at it from one point of view. But my decision-making will be guided by my belief that God exists, that the way I behave matters to Him, and that God will bless those who bless Israel is a pretty good foreign policy.
What will your leadership provide that is unique when compared to the other candidates seeking the Republican nomination?
I will be the most uniquely qualified commander-in-chief in a very, very long time. I've been on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan 35 times, 140 days as an Air Force reservist, learning the details and the intricacies of this war and how to destroy radical Islam. It would be the purpose of my presidency. So when your next speaker suggests that George W. Bush was somehow a loser because the towers came down on his watch, I wish Mr. Trump would apologize to George W. I love George W. Bush. I think he is a good man. He took the fight to Islam. He kept us safe, and everything he built, Obama's undercut. So if you don't understand that George W. Bush's way of dealing with radical Islam is the right way, hit them over there before they hit you here. I'm uniquely qualified to be commander-in-chief. I'm uniquely qualified to sell social conservatism because I work with Democrats on occasion and I'm hard to pigeonhole. I'm uniquely qualified to deal with immigration. For the last 10 years, I've been in every gang we've had. If we had tattoos, I had an armful. I know the issue. I know what the trade-offs have to be. I'm uniquely qualified to tell American people from a Republican point of view, Social Security is worth saving. I'm uniquely qualified to talk with Hillary Clinton about Benghazi because I have been there. Where were you when these people needed you the most? How could you not know of their 5 requests for additional security? And why did you lie about how they died? Hell no, I'm not giving up on Benghazi. Put me in the ring with her. I will ask her to her face. This is your time to be commander-in-chief. It wasn't a 3 a.m. phone call, it was 5 in the afternoon. Where were you? Why was Susan Rice on TV, not you? What did she have to do with the consulate security? 4 people died on her watch. It's not about the emails, Bernie's right. Partly about the emails, mostly about leadership. How could you not know that your people were in a death trap? The British left, why didn't we leave? The Red Cross withdrew, why did we stay? How could you possibly not know of a cable on 15 August begging for additional security? The flag of Al-Qaeda is flying all over Benghazi. We can't defend this place. And she turned a deaf ear to their request. So what was the question? I'm uniquely qualified to win.
Final 2 questions, Senator, in the negative 30 seconds we have left. When you look at, I mean, you've talked about all the stuff that Barack Obama has done and what he's put in place. Historically, Republicans come in and they just stop it. But our nation stands at a point where we must undo it,
totally.
Which could make you an unpopular president. Would you be willing to simply be a one-term president to do the right thing?
Hey, listen, I had 6 primary opponents in South Carolina, from mildly disturbed to completely insane, because I believe in fixing immigration. I mean, the Hispanic vote, you could put like up here. I don't mind being taken on hard things, and I don't mind people disagreeing with me. What I will not do as your president is tell you something I don't believe.
Fair enough. Final question for you, Senator. You've come here today to make your case to conservative leaders from across the country why you should be the commander-in-chief. My question is this: if you're successful in winning the White House, would you come back and continue the conversation with these conservative leaders once in office?
Not only would I come back and continue the conversation, you would be welcomed in my White House. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Lindsey Graham.